Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Don't forget, we are simulcasting on 90.7 FM and 101.1 FM. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to some of the residents from the Santa Fe Art Institute in preparation for their open studios, which is happening on Thursday. Right now, I would like to welcome Michael Otterman. He is the author of the book, American Torture, From the Cold War to Abu Ghraib and Beyond, published by Pluto Press, and he will be speaking tonight at 6:30 at Collected Works Bookstore in downtown Santa Fe, right across the street from the Lensic. He'll also be speaking at the College of Santa Fe at 3:15 at the O'Shaughnessy Theater in Benildis Hall. Welcome, Michael Otterman.
All right. Thanks for having me in.
It's great to have you here. Now, this is a book, ladies and gentlemen, do not turn your radios off. It deals with tough stuff, but it is endlessly fascinating, especially there was so much I didn't know about the origins of the kind of things we're seeing right now in Abu Ghraib in the 1950s. You go over the history of torture methods used by the United States going back to the middle of the 20th century, and some of these methods were used and taught to a large extent from Soviet Russia and Communist China.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. The reason why I wrote the book, for several reasons, but one of the big reasons is I wanted to kind of contextualize the abuses we see today, Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, because the fact is these aren't the only scandals involving torture the United States has been involved in. And even the methods used in places like Abu Ghraib didn't come from thin air. The fact is, beginning in the late 40s and early 50s, the United States studied torture, specifically the CIA and the Pentagon studied torture, tried to figure out what works, what doesn't work, slowly refined techniques. And by the mid-60s, had a working model of torture. And this all came about, well, again, during the early Cold War, where there was a real fear that, it's kind of irrational in retrospect, but there's a real fear that the Soviet Union, the Communist China, had somehow mastered what was called brainwashing, figured out how to twist a man's mind and make them say anything.
Now, brainwashing, I think it's important to note, is a very recent term. It only comes from the 1950s?
Yeah, it was actually coined by a covert CIA operative to label what they believed the Chinese communists were doing to downed U.S. pilots during the Korean War. Because the fact is, about 70% of U.S. pilots shot down in Korea ended up cooperating with their captors. So it's about 70% signed petitions, make statements against the U.S., and that created a certain level of fear, especially in the Pentagon, that what are these guys up to? How are they turning these men against the country?
And, I mean, it's not to be downplayed. I mean, they really had some pretty horrifying methods.
Yeah, well, the communist methods are what we call today no-touch tortures. They'd simply stand someone up in a room in an uncomfortable position for hours at a time. They put someone in a room, change the temperatures, very hot, very cold, turn the lights off, feed prisoners irregularly. These are psychological tortures that, if used correctly, they don't leave any physical markings, but they're deeply powerful because they affect the mind. And so, say you look at the Soviet show trials in the 30s and 40s, where outspoken opponents of, say, the regime in Hungary, before they're arrested, they would make pretty strong statements against the government. Suddenly they're arrested. A few days later, they stand up in court and admit to all these imagined crimes against the state. Stalin, you know, he would use these methods. He would just put someone in a cell, turn the lights off for a few days. Not him personally, but, you know, the Russian security forces. And these methods work because in these conditions, prisoners, not only are they disoriented and there's a huge level of fear, but they actually grow dependent on their captors. And this dependence is key. If you want someone to sign a false confession, because when you put someone in a position like this, they look at their interrogator as almost their only source of human contact, their only source of the fulfillment of, you know, basic human needs. And human beings become incredibly pliable in these situations.
You document early government programs, United States government programs, that involve the administration of drugs like LSD, sometimes to unwitting subjects who don't even know that they were being drugged.
Yeah, it was very shocking when I came across this type of material. I should say, just in general, the book that I've written, it uses almost exclusively declassified U.S. government documents. So this isn't coming from second, third, fourth hand information. What you mentioned with these LSD experiments. Well, in the 1950s, the CIA spent a great deal of money and time investigating LSD. They saw considered fantastic possibilities with the drug as a potential truth serum. So they spent, like I said, millions of dollars investigating it. And this took the form of, at certain stages, the CIA set up dummy foundations that would fund research at universities with this drug. But at the same time, they did a lot more covert investigations. In the late 50s, they had a safe house in New York City, in Greenwich Village, where agents would lure back unsuspecting Americans. And once they were in the safe house, they'd dose their drinks with LSD and other drugs. And from behind two-way mirrors, agents would observe the behaviors of these unsuspecting Americans.
And so some of those unsuspecting Americans were the johns of prostitutes. They would hire prostitutes, get them to lure these men back, and then give them LSD.
That's just right. In San Francisco, they used prostitutes in an operation they called Operation Midnight Climax. There's a certain level of sixth sense of humor, I guess.
Dark humor.
Yeah, but in Operation Midnight Climax, that's just right. They used prostitutes to lure men back to the safe house where their drinks and food were dosed.
And then they would observe the effects of LSD. And were, for example, in the United States, were confessions coerced using drugs the way they were in Soviet Russia?
Well, what the CIA found by the late 50s and early 60s is drugs like these, they don't work. They're not an effective tool for interrogation. It's these psychological methods of standing someone up, turning off the lights, making them dependent. These are actually the methods that work. This is what the Soviet Union's using. So the CIA never used drugs like LSD in a major way in interrogations, although you do hear reports, say in the early 1960s, there's a case of a communist defector, this guy named Nosenko, who defected to the United States and wanted to work for the CIA, for the U.S., but they were a bit wary. They thought maybe he was a mole sent by the KGB to infiltrate the CIA. So what happened is they put him in a safe house. He was actually in prison for nearly 3 years, and the idea was they wanted to see if he was a bona fide defector or if he was a spy. And so they used the full gamut of these Soviet techniques on him, kept him in this dark chamber, regulated his food, the lights, blaring sounds, temperature control. After about a year or two, he didn't admit to being a spy, but the powers that be in the CIA, they actually believed he was, and so they reverted back to the LSD and other drugs to see if he would crack under these types of things. He didn't, and so after a period of nearly 3 years, he was actually taken out of detention, put into rehabilitation. He was given an identity within the U.S., a new identity, and given $100,000 or so to kind of just go away. So LSD was used in his case. There's reports that psychoactive drugs are being used now today in black site prisons, CIA prisons. There's been reports that Jose Padilla, the U.S. citizen that was held in a military brig without charge for 3 years, he was classified an enemy combatant by the Pentagon. There's been reports that he was drugged with drugs like LSD. This is something he's claimed through his lawyers. It's hard to tell, though, because when you're put in extreme sensory deprivation, like Jose Padilla was, hallucinations are one of the byproducts of that. So it's not clear if these were hallucinations brought on by intense sensory deprivation or, indeed, drugs like LSD.
We're talking to Michael Otterman, author of the book American Torture, From the Cold War to Abu Ghraib and Beyond. The military and the CIA got interested, as you said, in mind control research, and then there were stress inoculation programs designed to help soldiers withstand torture.
Yeah, well, that's a big part of the story.
And, of course, these turned into torture programs themselves.
Exactly. Like I was saying, the CIA was investigating things like LSD and other drugs in the 1950s, but the Pentagon, they kind of went down a different track. Starting in the early 50s, they opened these survival schools. Today, they're known as SEER schools, which stands for Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape. And the key element in these schools is resistance training. And what that entails is torturing, literally torturing U.S. soldiers in very controlled situations with a doctor or often a psychologist present, with the idea that if they're ever captured in real life, they'd be much better prepared to handle any torture that they come across behind enemy lines. And so this is a program that started in the early 1950s, and you have these SEER schools in California and Maine, Colorado and Washington State, where starting in the 50s, but still today, special forces, soldiers, aviators, they go through this training. This is very rigorous training. It's torture training to prepare them for in case they're ever captured. And so this has been going on for decades, and actually it spread to the United Kingdom. There's a level of this type of training in the UK and in Australia. Other militaries do this as well. But after 9/11, things changed. There always was torture going on in the U.S. military experience, in Latin America, in Vietnam. It talked about even within the U.S. with, say, this communist defector. After 9/11, things changed. A lot of this came out of the shadows. Torture was actually authorized at the highest levels. Before, it was something done behind closed doors. But now, soon after 9/11, you know, you have George Bush talking about enhanced interrogation methods. Incidentally, the phrase enhanced methods was a term coined by the Nazis to describe their interrogation techniques, which incidentally were the same, standing people up for long periods of time, turning off the lights, changing the temperatures, so on and so forth. You never had the President of the United States talking and advocating torture until after 9/11. And only a week after 9/11, September 17th, George Bush authorized the CIA to kill, capture, or detain anyone they deemed to be al-Qaeda. And essentially, the CIA was given the green light to torture. Where did they turn to for expertise on torture? Well, they went to these survival schools that have been training U.S. soldiers to resist these techniques since the 1950s. So by late 2001, you have officials with the SEER program meeting with the CIA and CIA interrogators and training them in these Soviet torture techniques. These same advisors from the SEER program were sent to Guantanamo to work with interrogators there.
And there's a tremendous irony, which is that sometimes one has heard government officials saying, well, you know, this isn't torture, this isn't anything that we don't do to our own soldiers.
Well, I mean, it's torture if you... That's a line that you hear often.
Yeah, when it's being done to U.S. soldiers, yeah, there's doctors and psychologists and so on right there to make sure that they don't crack.
Yeah, I mean, I'd argue it's still torture, even if it is in a controlled situation, because if you talk to someone who's gone through this type of training, it's the worst. It's probably the worst element of their military experience. It's oftentimes they don't even like to talk about it because it's incredibly affecting on their minds.
I mean, there was a line in the book where you said that people who've gone through programs like that often don't have the stomach to then do that to other people.
Yeah, I mean, the CIA in particular, they do this type of stress inoculation as well, and oftentimes, if you're going to be the torturer inflicting it on the new recruits, you have to go through the process yourself. And, yeah, many of the people that go through it don't even want to be the instructor afterwards because it's just so horrifying to go through. And so there's a lot of debate out there if this stress inoculation even works. Some former POWs swear by it. They thank the SEER program for giving them the tools, the mental kind of preparation to get through the POW experience. Others say it didn't really help them, that under a certain amount of pain, you're going to crack anyway. So there's a debate out there if these programs are even effective. But at the bottom line is, after 9/11, these programs were exploited by the Bush administration for their expertise in torture. And there's actually going to be a Senate Armed Services Committee investigation into the exploitation of the SEER program. This is something being led by Senator Levin, into the exploitation of this program and flipping these methods of protection into actual torture to use on enemy combatants.
We're talking to Michael Otterman, author of the book American Torture, and he's going to be speaking tonight at 6:30 at the Collected Works Bookstore in downtown Santa Fe, and also at 3:30 at the O'Shaughnessy Theater in Benildis Hall on the campus of the College of Santa Fe. Some of the most horrific torture inflicted by the United States on others was in Vietnam. Tell us about the Phoenix program.
Well, the Phoenix program was probably the first case where you have the United States engaging in torture in almost a systematic and large scale. The Phoenix program was a joint CIA special forces operation that targeted not soldiers, not Viet Cong military, but actually civilians. And that was quite explicit in the charter of this program, essentially. It targeted VCI, Viet Cong infrastructure, which essentially was considered people deemed sympathetic to the Viet Cong, civilians that were sympathetic to the Viet Cong cause.
But I mean, we're talking about farmers and
essentially anyone, yeah. any civilian in the North. And so, according to CIA's own estimates, over 20,000 of these civilians were neutralized or killed. According to the New York Times, it's more like 60,000. But the program essentially was they'd capture groups of people, interrogate them, see who was supporting the Viet Cong, and not use this information to capture more people. But torture was used explicitly in this program. The CIA actually had over 40 interrogation centers in every province in South Vietnam where these tortures, these psychological tortures were used, but even more brutal physical tortures. Often it was their Vietnamese counterparts that would perform the most brutal tortures. But
Involving electricity and things that, I mean, we don't even want to talk about on the radio.
Oh, yeah. The most graphic parts of the book take place, I think, during the Phoenix program.
Very much so.
Because there's zero oversight. And CIA and their Vietnamese counterparts essentially had their way with these prisoners.
And they even had quotas of how many people they had to kill within certain time periods, and they would just basically choose people, torture them, and kill them.
Yeah, there was quotas set up by the headquarters in Saigon, where the Phoenix operatives in the field, they would have to catch 1,200 VCIs, Viet Cong infrastructure, civilian infrastructure, people per month, 1,200, 1,000, 2,000, it would change every month. So this drove this program of torture, and it's been described essentially as a murder program by people that have been involved in this operation.
So this is called the Phoenix program, which spread to Latin America. I thought we could talk for a moment about the story of an American named Dan Mitrone.
Yeah. Well, Dan Mitrone he's from Indianapolis. He was described as, an all-American boy. He was the police chief in Richmond. And by the late 50s, early 60s, he joined the FBI. And he became a part of this, it's now defunct, called the Office of Public Safety, which was part of a branch of of USAID. And their job was to train Latin American police forces and organize Latin American police forces. During the Cold War, the U.S. spent billions of dollars training police and military of our Latin American allies. Oftentimes, it was brutal right-wing regimes that, were deemed kind of the bulwark against any type of Soviet threat in Latin America. So Dan Mitrone was part of this Office of Public Safety, which trained police. And essentially, he is known as almost the Johnny Appleseed of these psychological tortures, because everywhere he went, He would advocate the use of these no-touch tortures in Brazil and in Uruguay and elsewhere. He would advise, you know, put someone in a room, turn the lights off, strip them naked, humiliate them. This is how you break people down, make them dependent. And he, at the time, torture was used in Latin America, but it was more medieval type of stuff with electricity and other things. But he was quite proud of modernizing the interrogation or torture techniques of the countries that he worked in. And so you see it quite explicitly from the accounts of his victims, the people he worked with. These are the tortures he advocated, and this is indeed what was used by police in Uruguay.
And horrifyingly sadistic and effective in breaking people's spirits, but I think it's very important to talk about how effective it is. I mean, you know, it's obviously a form of incredible sadism, just an end in itself, as you write in the book. But, I mean, does it do anything besides break people's spirits? Does it have, do people actually tell the truth under torture?
No, well, I mean, torture works, if you want to say it works, in some level. It works if you want someone to sign a false confession, to admit to some imagined crime, to stand up before a judge and say, I did this and I did that. In that sense, torture does work, because people are willing to say anything to avoid a cessation of pain, especially extreme pain.
Do the people who are inflicting this pain on others, psychological and physical, have any way of determining whether the result they get is true?
Well, you know, I'm not going to say you never get anything that's true, but if in a torture situation.
But I mean, are you able to sort it out?
Well, that's the problem, because you don't know what's true and what's not true. I mean, look at a good example now is the torture of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, KSM. The mastermind of 9/11. We do know that he was involved in the planning of 9/11 and involved in certain other plots. But under CIA torture, which involved waterboarding, which is when you lay someone down, flood their mouth with water, make them gag and retch and believe that they are essentially drowning. It's a form of mock execution that goes back to the Inquisition. This was a very popular torture used in the Inquisition. It was used in World War II. By the Japanese. And actually, during the Tokyo trials after the war, Japanese generals were sentenced 10, 15 years in prison or more for authorizing this torture. Anyway, this is a torture, among others, that was authorized by George Bush in a presidential finding after 9/11. And under this torture, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed did speak. But what did he say? Well, he admitted to over 31 different plots, stretching back to the early 90s. He claimed that he personally beheaded Danny Pearl, this Washington, this Wall Street Journal reporter. If you speak to Danny Pearl's family and other people that actually know what's going on with this case and with this murder, KSM had nothing to do with this murder. But under torture, he admitted to that. He admitted to, again, 30 other plots. Again, 9/11, we do know maybe he helped plan, but these other things are quite far-fetched. He claimed that he was planning to bomb this building in Washington, which wasn't even built in 2006. He was captured in 2003. It just doesn't make sense. That's the problem with torture. Because even if you do have someone like KSM who you know or you think you know is a real terrorist, so to speak, under torture, they're going to give you garbage. And you don't know what's true and what's not true. The fact is there's actually better ways to interrogate people. The FBI, for example, uses what's called rapport-building techniques. They don't torture their suspects. They actually treat their prisoners with respect and respect their human rights. Not just because they want to be nice, but because they know and they've found over time that if you treat someone with respect and, hey, if they're thirsty, give them something to drink. If they want to pray, let them pray. The information that you get from people is actually a lot better, and it's something that you can actually use in a courtroom, and it could hold up in a courtroom because it wasn't taken under torture. And the FBI uses these methods not only with criminal cases here in the U.S., but with terrorism cases, especially before 9/11. It was the FBI investigating the first World Trade Center bombing. They were investigating the embassy bombings in East Africa in 1998. And the interrogation methods they used were these nonviolent rapport-building methods. Using these methods, they were able to build cases against the perpetrators of these actions. And these methods work. So this is what I'm trying to advocate with the book as well.
We're talking to Michael Otterman. As you say, torture does not have the effect of getting reliable information. It does, however, have the effect of destroying political movements by literally terrorizing the people who are in them, and the people, not only those who are tortured, but those who are their friends and colleagues.
Yeah, well, so torture works, like I said, if you want to get a false confession. Torture also works as a form of terrorism. It literally instills terror in obviously the person you're torturing, but also the wider population. So when people ask me, why are we torturing? You know, obviously it doesn't work, and people know, people make, you know, you'll just make stuff up under torture. Well, one of the aims of torture throughout time has been to instill fear in populations.
And that does work.
And that, I mean, it does work if that's your aim. And that reminds me of something a fellow author told me, this guy Stephen Gray. He wrote this terrific book called Ghost Plane. If your listeners are interested in this topic of torture, rendition especially, pick up Ghost Plane, because he talks about just the rendition program. This is the CIA program sending prisoners to states that torture, use extreme torture. Anyway, he told me that when he was in Washington recently, he was actually thanked by some of his contacts in the CIA for putting out this book on rendition. And he wasn't being thanked because he's bringing to light some bad thing and now it's going to stop. He was actually thanked by his contacts because they said, now people will know what we're doing in the CIA and the terrorists will know how tough we could get. And so he was actually being thanked for telling the world, so to speak, what the CIA is doing. And I don't think this represents everyone in the agency, but these guys anyway thanked him for help spreading the word, so to speak, of how brutal this country is and how brutal the CIA is. So that kind of confirmed to me that is part of it, spreading fear.
We're talking to Michael Otterman. A year ago, a new code was announced by the United States banning torture by the U.S. Armed Services, but it doesn't apply to the CIA.
No, well, after Abu Ghraib, I mean, obviously Abu Ghraib was a massive embarrassment for the United States. Even George Bush has said, when asked what he regrets, and he doesn't often admit, you know, regret or remorse, these types of things, but when asked about it, he actually has said Abu Ghraib is one of the worst things that's happened in Iraq. And he's quite right. Before Abu Ghraib, actually a poll was taken by the CPA, the Coalition Provisional Authority, and about 60% of Iraqis actually supported what the U.S. was doing in Iraq. This is in 2000, I guess this would have been in 2004. A few weeks after the Abu Ghraib images came out, the same poll was taken, and they found that number dropped from 60% support down to 9% support for the United States in Iraq. So it's been disastrous, not just in Iraq, but obviously around the world. So after Abu Ghraib, these types of tortures, these psychological tortures, were scaled back, and you have a new Army field manual for interrogators, which says you cannot waterboard people, you cannot strip people down naked, put them in a room, turn the lights off. It takes away the authority to do all these types of things. The problem is the CIA, you know, doesn't follow military guidelines. The CIA follows directions from the executive, from the president. And legally, they follow the guidance of the Department of Justice. And so currently, the CIA is authorized, and the Department of Justice has authorized the CIA to continue to use an array of tortures.
And they have 14,000 prisoners in various prisons, Iraq, Afghanistan, and other places.
Well, that's the scariest thing. The latest numbers might shock you, but currently, according to the New York Times, just about a week and a half ago, the U.S. holds 60,000 what's called security detainees in Iraq. 60,000 people in U.S. prisons in Iraq, about 1,000 or two in Afghanistan, in places like the Bagram Air Base. And in Guantanamo, we currently hold about 360 people. And so Well, fortunately, the military runs the bulk of these prisons. And like I said, the military is not authorized to torture. But the CIA does have access to these facilities. The CIA's secret prison program is still active, supposedly. According to people I've talked to, there's prisons possibly in Western Sahara, in North Africa. That seems to be the new place for these prisons. Anyway, the CIA is authorized to use these tortures, specifically sensory deprivation and forced standing, standing people up for 40 hours at a time, which is excruciating. Waterboarding, there's some debate whether it's still authorized or if it's still being used.
Well, I mean, so you have these secret prisons, you have Abu Ghraib, you have the use of torture that goes back to the 50s and certainly before, often justified as a defense against something else, whether it be communism or terrorism or whatever. What's really going on? I mean, is it pure sadism? Is it just the dark side of human nature?
Well, on some level it is. I mean, after 9/11, you have Dick Cheney, you know, going on Meet the Press and saying, we now have to go to the dark side. This is what he said in the days after 9/11. We have to essentially fight dirty in this, quote-unquote, new war on terror. You know, retribution was part of it, especially, you know, it was in the wake of 9/11 that all these types of things were approved by the Department of Justice and by the White House. And so that you know, torture does kind of satisfy this primal urge of, you know, of I don't know what you want to call it, this of violence, of getting back, of retribution. And that played in a big way after 9/11. And, you know, now we're now 5-6 years later. Like I said, these things are getting scaled back. But a week after 9/11, the CIA was authorized to kill, capture, detain anywhere in the world, essentially. The global war on terror is just that. It's a global war. The battlefield is considered to be everywhere, within the U.S., outside the U.S., from the North Pole to the South Pole. It doesn't matter. This is why you have people like Jose Padilla, a U.S. citizen, born in Brooklyn, classified an enemy combatant, held for 3 years without charge, tortured using all the techniques we've been talking about, maybe not waterboarded, but all the other psychological techniques we've been talking about. It doesn't matter if you're captured in the U.S., outside the U.S., if you're a U.S. citizen. This is kind of the philosophy now of this global war on terror, and it's scary.
I was sitting last night reading this book on my couch in a comfortable room with a belly full of food and so very aware of the comfort that is my life and that probably is the lives of most of our listeners most of the time, much of the time. How do you get people to understand this? I mean, if there's a tendency, if you're not open to it or if it's scary, to just close the book, shut off the dial, stop reading the article.
Well, it's hard. And I mean, even for me, this book took me about 3 years to write. I wrote it at first as kind of as a journalist, somewhat detached. I was kind of reporting these things. But it wasn't until I started to sit down with real victims, torture victims, that personally it hit home. In particular, I spent a great deal of time with one guy, Mamdu Habib, who is an Australian citizen. He was arrested in Pakistan by Pakistani police on suspicion of God knows what. But he was turned over, not to Australian authorities, but he was turned over to the U.S. authorities, rendered by the CIA to Egypt, tortured for 6 months there with extreme physical tortures, burning, being held, you know, hung upside down, these medieval types of things.
I mean, you tell his story in the book, and he was a man who owned a cleaning company in Australia.
He's an Australian citizen, Australian passport. Yet he was born in Egypt, and I think maybe that's why the CIA felt comfortable rendering him there. But he was held for 6 months in Egypt, and under these extreme physical and psychological tortures, he admitted to anything that was put in front of him. So he admitted to training the 9/11 hijackers in martial arts. He admitted to providing, training to Hezbollah and facilitating chemical weapons transfers to Hezbollah. You know, all these crazy, crazy things. After he signed his name to these things in Egypt, he was given back to the U.S., sent to, briefly to Afghanistan, to Bagram, and then to Guantanamo, where if you look at his rap sheet, essentially, everything he admitted to under torture in Egypt, he was being charged with in Guantanamo. Fortunately, the Washington Post found out about his case, ran a front-page story in early 2005 about the torture of Mamdou Habib, and about a week or two later, he was actually transferred back, with no explanation, back to Australia after his case.
And released.
And released back free in Australia. Anyway, so I got to spend time with this guy, and he was, well, his story was compelling because he has scars, you know, of the types of torture that were used on him, physical scars on his chest, and he is, I say in the book, he's a broken man. He's damaged. He's damaged goods, so to speak.
As are virtually all people who undergo these things.
Yeah, it breaks a part of you. It breaks the human spirit. And it was, once I really saw this in another human being, it really brought home a lot of the stuff I was talking about, and it made it all the more real and all the more affecting. So in terms of your readers, I mean, you know, that's what did it for me. That's what brought it all home for me. Incidentally, I'm talking now with Amnesty International about bringing this real-life replica of a Guantanamo cell to the United States. It's currently in Australia. Amnesty Australia spent a great deal of money building this cell. It's an exact replica of a Guantanamo cell. And they toured it around Australia, all the capital cities and country towns. And people, it's when you see this cell, when you go inside this cell, it really brings home what's going on. And so now I'm talking with Amnesty about bringing it here to the U.S., hopefully bringing it to Santa Fe, Albuquerque, and elsewhere. That's incredibly helpful to understand what these victims of torture go through.
Michael Otterman, unfortunately, it's time to go, but I want to thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me again. Thanks.
Michael Otterman is the author of the book American Torture from the Cold War to Abu Ghraib and Beyond, published by Pluto Press. He is speaking tonight at 6:30 at Collected Works Bookstore, which is in downtown Santa Fe on San Francisco Street, across the street from the Lenzic Theater. And he's also at the College of Santa Fe today from 3:15 to 5:15 at the O'Shaughnessy Theater in Benildis Hall. We're going to be taking... Oh, by the way, I want to let people know also, in the context of all this, that on October 1st, there is an event called Poems from Guantanamo, a reading and discussion. I will be one of the readers at that event. It's at the First Presbyterian Church on Grant Avenue at 7 o'clock on October 1st, which I believe is a Monday. We're going to take a little break right now, and when we come back, we will be speaking with the folks from the Santa Fe Art Institute. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Rachel Cohen and Patty Rosenblatt. They are from they're residents at the Santa Fe Art Institute, and they will be showing a little bit of their work on Thursday at the Santa Fe Art Institute at 4 o'clock. Welcome, ladies.
Thank you.
You have a very interesting collaboration. You've worked together before you got to Santa Fe. A dancer, a choreographer, and a ceramics artist. That's not a usual combination.
Well... Patty works with raw clay rather than firing it, and I work with materials in my choreography. We work with dough, taffy, different substances that you can play around with, and I was interested in clay. And then a friend of mine introduced me to Patty because she thought that we would have interests in common, and we wanted to start playing around.
And so you actually use unfired clay somehow as a medium in dance, not just as, yes, as a sculptural medium.
Right. My work is really with raw earths, exploring their natural properties and relating to the landscape. And so I think to work with Rachel, I create forms that she can then use as triggers. She asks for forms to move with her that then serve as triggers for me. But really it's about the form and the human form and the landscape.
There are so many creation myths that come that where the human body was, or the human was developed from clay or from the earth or from
right.
the earth, so it just seems like a natural combination. And then to be able to get inside some of the landscapes that Patty creates and almost become one with the clay, it becomes another performer or another dancer. So we really become indistinguishable in some ways, and that connects into these creationists, and then also the idea that when we die, we also go back into the earth.
Into the earth. What is the tradition of dance from which you come?
I started out ballet as a very young girl, and then switched into modern. Then had a teacher, Claire Malardi, at Harvard University, who really opened my mind about what could fall into the category of dance. It was much more about self-expression and theater and really art in general, and less about specific dance technique. So since then, I've just tried to go my own way, using principles of dance that I learned, but also of other art forms, and try to mix them together to create my own vocabulary, I guess.
One of the things that I found interesting about the work that you're doing is that you're making forms that look like heavy, sculptural, earthy forms, but you've managed to make them incredibly lightweight so that Rachel can dance with them.
Yes, that's some of Rachel's notions of what she'd like to dance with are, they do refer to the clay, but I think there's always a bit of artifice in art, and what we're doing is representing rather than always having the actuality of it. But she has danced with heavy clay, but wanted a wider range of movement. And I have discovered an additive, actually, that's used in conservation of pots in museums, and it's this lightweight glass bubble. 3M makes it. I'm trying some other materials now, too. But if you add it to the clay, you can really make clay that's almost as light as meringue.
When you, on Thursday, are demonstrating your work at the Santa Fe Art Institute, what will people see?
Well, yesterday, we laid out some clay that we've mixed together to allow it to dry. So we will hopefully have a couple of landscapes that we've worked on laid out that we may be able to talk about and possibly move through to show what we're doing. We also have some structures that Patty's created for me to move with. So hopefully we'll have something for people to see. We're here mostly to explore, so we don't have a performance planned, but we still have lots of exciting things in progress that we're working on, and we'll have some video also of previous work that can be shown so people can see a more final product of what we've done.
And so this is at 4 o'clock at the Santa Fe Art Institute. Rachel Cohen and Patty Rosenblatt.
Thank you.
Let's turn now to Julie Pierre. You're also a resident at the Santa Fe Art Institute. You are from New Orleans, and
yes,
you're under the program at Santa Fe Art Institute that brings artists from New Orleans who've lost their studios and stuff to Santa Fe.
Right. So it's really nice to be here and around like a great big group of creative people and everything, and just to have like a really nice open dialogue with artists, you know, from different parts of the country.
You are working on a project that involves teeth.
Teeth, exactly. And I brought my camera today to take a picture of your teeth, Mary Charlotte, because I didn't get to do it yesterday. So I've been going around Santa Fe, strictly like in the plaza. I can't drive a car right now because I got in a little trouble back home, but so I'm taking pictures of people's teeth around town, and it's kind of interesting when I ask people, can I take a picture of teeth? People are really sensitive, you know. It's something that they really either hide because maybe they're ashamed of their teeth because they're not perfect, or if they are perfect, they're still kind of freaked out, but they're more proud and excited to show me their teeth. I notice if that person has really straight white teeth.
And then you are making artworks out of directly or indirectly, people's teeth that involve drawing and painting and carving.
Right. So I've been carving teeth on soap, and everything's in 32, except for the paintings, because they're really big and it takes me forever to paint. But so the soap is used because it's like just this obnoxious way to be like, get your teeth really white and everything. And as we were talking yesterday, I talked to my mom, you know, I'm from the South, and my family years ago had a plantation, and my mom was like, yeah, you know, well, your family, they used to wash their teeth with soap, you know, and they all had rotten teeth, you know. So it's just kind of a funny thing. But all the teeth, the majority of the teeth are not perfect. They're crooked. There's some missing, but they're still perfect. They're still white. You know?
I think part of what is interesting about this project is that it brings out so many people's attitudes and prejudices regarding teeth.
Right. You know.
What have you found?
No, the same thing, you know, and just, I mean, that whole idea came from me working at this fancy bar back home in New Orleans, and I kept looking at a lot of the guests' teeth. These are people with a lot of money. They're very well-dressed, and they have these gorgeous, impeccable teeth. Yet the people that I work with, some of them have just kind of, like, average-looking teeth, but some of them have, like, really messed up, crooked teeth. And the further you go back in the kitchen, the worse the teeth seem to get, you know? So it's like this whole class thing, you know?
And when you question people about their attitudes, what kind of responses do you get?
One guy gave me a really good response, you know, because I was asking him, he's like, there's nothing wrong with my teeth. And he had, like, these just really crooked, stained teeth. He smokes and he drinks, right? And I said, well, I think they're kind of messed up, but I like the fact that they're messed up. And he's like, my teeth show my character, blah, 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 blah. You know, so he really thinks it really represents who he is as a person, you know.
So you will be showing your work at the Santa Fe Art Institute in the open studios at 4 o'clock on Thursday, and I want to make sure that we also get to Jillian Conrad. Welcome.
Hi.
And you are doing work that involves geology, basically. They're either using rocks or using things that are not rocks but look like them.
Right, right. In my work as a sculptor, I believe there's a connection between the internal landscape that each of us has, an emotional landscape, and the external landscape that we move through, be it rocks or buildings or anything like that. And so using rocks in this particular body of work is an easy way for me to kind of have a solid representation of something physical and use the geological process or refer to them, such as sedimentation and accretion and layering, accident, chance, purpose. All of these things are contained in a single rock, and I feel like that's a great metaphor for our own internal lives.
How would you think of sedimentation in a geological sense? How do you think of it in a human psychological sense?
I think of it maybe not even entirely psychological, but more about experience, in the sense that it just passing through time in a single day, all the things that happen to you, all the people that you meet, the experiences you have, the emotions that you have, and how most of those things, you can't even examine all of them. They just are constantly going on. And that's the part that I find interesting about rocks and geology as well, is you can't, there's so much in there that you pick out a few, you know, important parts.
Some things stick, I suppose,
yeah.
And some don't.
Right, exactly. And some things form you, you know, and some things don't. Some things come up later, you discover later. That's an important part, too, is the idea of, say, like a geode or of cracking a rock open, and that something bright could come out of that, like light coming out or like the beauty of an interior geode. That's another direct metaphor for me in terms of, you know, having important experiences in your life.
And so you're working with materials that some of them are very lightweight, but then you make them sort of boulder-like.
Right. In one large installation I'm doing right now, I'm making it out of foam, just the kind of insulation foam that you use in your home. But I'm covering it in such a way, I'm covering it with Venetian plaster and different materials so that the foam part actually disappears. So it looks, I want it to absolutely look heavy on the front side. On the back side, you'll be able to see that it's actually a hollow form.
Well, Jillian Conrad, Julie Pieri, Rachel Cohen, and Patty Rosenblatt, and many more residents will be at the Santa Fe Art Institute from 4 until 6 o'clock on Thursday, talking about their work. Thank you so much for being here, ladies.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, the Jazz Hoedown. Simulcasting on 90.7 FM and 101.1 FM, we are KSFR, Santa Fe's only public radio station. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.